It is Sunday, July 12th. We are looking at a party in flux, the quiet colonization of our neighborhoods by AI, and the increasingly desperate search for relevance in legacy media. Following up on yesterday's look at institutional lag, the cracks are starting to show in some surprising places. Let's get into it. We start with the Democratic primary for 2028. Following a series of private meetings between party donors and leadership this week, Vice President Kamala Harris is facing significant resistance from institutional insiders. Harris is currently leading in the polls, but there is a sharp divide. Some supporters argue the 2024 campaign was too short to build real infrastructure and that she deserves a full cycle to prove herself. Others, including prominent donor John Morgan, see the last election as a mandate to move on entirely. The risk for Harris is a donor drought. If the money flows toward alternatives like Andy Beshear, Mark Kelly, or Wes Moore, her campaign could be labeled a non-starter before it even gains momentum. It's a classic competence trap. Voters might support her ideologically, but they are already questioning her electability in a system they believe is biased. Moving to international affairs, the administration's handling of the Iran conflict is drawing scrutiny. Some analysts suggest the current diplomatic approach is failing to secure the Strait of Hormuz, effectively leaving Iran as the owner-operator of that vital waterway. While the economic fallout has been softer than anticipated, that is largely due to strategic moves by China, which has boosted Beijing's global standing while highlighting the limits of American influence. The administration seems to have mistaken a lack of immediate catastrophe for a strategic win. That is a dangerous assumption, and it likely delays necessary diplomacy until the political costs become unavoidable. On the home front, we are seeing a systemic breakdown in how political parties handle candidates. The focus has shifted toward rage-based, outsider figures, and the vetting process is falling apart. We saw this with the main Democratic nominee, where a candidate with obvious red flags was put forward because party factions wanted an outsider. When parties prioritize performative aggression over character or due diligence, they create massive vulnerabilities. It also strips them of the moral high ground. Once you stop vetting to satisfy a base's demand for fury, you lose the ability to complain when your opponents do the exact same thing. It's a race to the bottom, and it's happening on both sides of the aisle. Related to that, we are seeing a growing crisis of transparency regarding our aging political class. Following recent reports on his health, the extended, unexplained absences of leaders like Mitch McConnell are under renewed scrutiny. These are people who hold immense power, yet their cognitive and physical health is being treated as a private matter. It is not. When the political class refuses to be transparent, it fuels conspiracy theories and erodes public trust. It creates a government that is essentially unable to validate its own legitimacy. If you cannot tell the public who is actually pulling the levers of power, you cannot be surprised when they stop believing the system works. In the tech sector, your smartphone is effectively functioning as an involuntary ankle monitor. This isn't a glitch. It is the core feature of the digital economy, through a legal loophole known as the third-party doctrine, which dates back to the 1970s. The government can access vast amounts of your data without a warrant, simply because that data is stored by a third party. This has been supercharged by AI and mercenary spyware. Even tools marketed as secure are failing. For example, some privacy researchers have raised concerns that AI-integrated features in mobile operating systems are logging user inputs in ways that could be used against you later to deny services or rights. This isn't just about privacy in the abstract. It creates a psychological environment of self-censorship. If you know your search queries or private conversations can be weaponized or leaked, you become less brave and less willing to challenge the status quo. We are seeing an institutional devaluation of rights where people are being monitored and categorized based on their associations before they have ever committed a crime. The only real defense at this point is active threat modeling, using hardened operating systems and decentralized platforms, because the default settings on your devices are designed to sell you out. There is a growing shift in how we talk about existential risk. We are obsessed with the idea of individual survival, the bunker, the supplies, the lone wolf. But the most urgent threats we face now are systemic and human-made. We are talking about AI and engineered pathogens that can scale with terrifying speed. The danger with AI isn't that it will develop a malicious personality. It is that it will pursue an objective without clear stop parameters, viewing any human intervention as an obstacle to be cleared. Integrating these systems into things like nuclear command and control is a massive risk, especially since it removes the human friction, like multi-person verification, that has kept us from accidental escalation for decades. The ironic thing here is that our current survival culture is completely backwards. If a major collapse happened, the people who would actually be useful aren't the ones who know how to hide in the woods. You need people who understand bureaucracy, project management, and community coordination. Our best defense against nuclear conflict or climate instability is diplomacy and shared information frameworks, not individual isolation. We keep spending our mental energy on the wrong things. We are terrified of the statistically unlikely, like asteroid impacts, while ignoring the fact that our own institutional fragility is what will likely cause the next big problem. Finally, we are seeing this fragility play out in how we manage public health and government oversight. In the education sector, the administration is planning to move special education staff to the Department of Health and Human Services while keeping legal oversight in the Department of Education. It is a bureaucratic workaround that breaks up a unified structure, and it is going to make it nearly impossible for parents to enforce standards under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. We see the same thing in public health. You have official CDC guidelines on things like breast milk storage, but those are being challenged by influencers citing small, unreviewed studies on social media. When institutions stop providing clear, trusted, and well-funded data, they leave parents to navigate complex risk assessments entirely on their own. It is the same story with prediction markets like Kalshi, pronounced K-A-L-Shi, which operate in a legal gray area because the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is too outdated to enforce actual rules. In every one of these cases, the institution is failing to lead. They are creating workarounds that mask the underlying cracks, forcing individuals to manage systemic risks with zero resources. It is a shitty way to run a country, and it's getting worse. Speaking of managed networks and systemic friction, it is not just our political parties struggling to keep the peace. Technology is doing the same thing to our front porches. Household AI is shifting from a personal tool into a shared, neighborhood-wide infrastructure. Systems meant for carpools and security are now effectively managing local community logistics, which creates a new kind of digital trap. If you opt out of these networks, you become a source of friction for your neighbors. The system works best when everyone participates, so the person who refuses to share data creates a dark zone that degrades the utility for everyone else. It is a classic tragedy of the commons, but with your living room floor plan as the collateral. Here is the thing that really stinks about this setup. These platforms are not organic, civic-minded projects. They are commercially engineered products. They leverage peer-to-peer guilt to force people into signing up. If you don't join, it is framed as a failure of your civic duty to the block, which honestly is a hell of a way to manufacture consent. People are not signing up because they love the product. They are signing up because they do not want to be the social pariah who ruined the neighborhood carpool. It is coercive, and it effectively outsources the company's marketing costs to your neighbors. Then there is the surveillance spillover. Think of this like secondhand smoke. When you activate your home security AI, you are not just logging your own movements. You are face-printing the delivery driver, the utility worker, and anyone walking their dog past your house. You are forcing the public to subsidize your personal security with their own anonymity, and they never signed a single terms of service agreement to make that trade. The long-term risk here is that these systems stop being optional conveniences and start becoming essential survival infrastructure. If municipal services or emergency responders eventually prioritize neighborhoods with total data transparency, opting out will carry actual physical consequences. At that point, privacy stops being an individual right and turns into a luxury. It becomes a choice that subjects you to systemic neglect. If the algorithm optimizes for the most visible data sets, the people who hold out for their privacy will be the ones structurally excluded from the services they are helping to fund. The friction of opting out is not a bug in these systems. It is a feature designed by the companies to ensure you eventually fold. They are replacing human discretion with binary connectivity. Every time you click that accept button, you are agreeing to let a commercial entity formalize your neighborly interactions. We are rapidly engineering a social reality where the right to remain unread is becoming incompatible with the duty to be counted on. It is a shitty situation, and it is happening one neighborhood at a time. That kind of digital capture is one way to keep people in line, but in the world of horse racing, they are trying a different play entirely. The horse racing industry is currently leaning hard into regional marquee events to keep the calendar moving. Tracks like Horseshoe Indianapolis and Prairie Meadows are concentrating their biggest races during the summer months. The strategy is simple. By avoiding the crowded, high-pressure weekends of the Triple Crown circuit, these tracks provide a lower-stress environment for horses to develop. It is working on the attendance front, with Horseshoe Indianapolis reporting a sold-out clubhouse. But look, there is a catch. These promotional events are often packed with one-time visitors who show up for the giveaways, but do not actually bet on the races. That creates a gap between the appearance of a successful track and the reality of stagnant betting handle. The claiming market in Kentucky remains a bottleneck. Demand for horses is so high that a single animal recently drew 21 separate claim flips. To manage this volatility, professional ownership groups are stepping in to help new owners navigate bloodstock acquisition and class management. The goal is to keep capital flowing, but the underlying risk remains. Trainers like Brett Calhoun, pronounced B-R-E-T Calhoun, who is nearing 4,000 career wins, are succeeding by prioritizing horses with predictable, consistent form across different surfaces. It is a focus on long-term planning over the short-term opportunism that historically plagues the sport. Then there is the attempt to turn racing into a team-based league, modeled after Formula One. The proposed horse racing league wants fans to follow teams across different tracks rather than just individual horses. It is a big swing, but it has a glaring structural problem. The league is currently using allowance-level horses rather than established stars. Without immediate name recognition, it is struggling to bridge the gap between a new commercial model and the established fan habit of following elite individual athletes. Meanwhile, internal discipline remains a flashpoint. Jockey Paco Lopez, pronounced Paco Lopez, was handed a 30-day suspension for what officials called gross, careless riding. This has reopened a messy debate about whether racing commissions rely on objective safety standards or just a rider's reputation. It is a subjective system that feels shaky to everyone involved. If these incidents continue to cause spills, the industry risks a regulatory reckoning or even a coordinated boycott by other riders. Finally, a look at the history book shows that the industry's obsession with potential is nothing new. In 1927, a horse named Handy Mandy, specifically the track record-setting performance at the Latonia, pronounced Latioenia Derby, was a maiden through 9 starts. She broke a North American record for 12 furlongs. She was sold for a price documented in historical archives as $75,000, which is roughly $1 million today. She finished her career with only 4 wins in 33 starts. Still, her ability to master extreme distances kept her value high. It is a reminder that in this game, one outlier performance can completely rewrite the value of an asset, regardless of the overall win percentage. Moving from the track to the boardroom, it seems like everyone wants to turn our attention into a revenue stream. Fanatics is officially trying to turn the sports industry into a 24/7 content machine. According to recent industry reporting, the company is pivoting from its traditional role as a retailer to a platform for massive, immersive fan events. They're treating athletes like social media influencers instead of just players. The goal is to move audiences away from passive, linear television broadcasts and toward high-frequency, shareable moments. This shift changes how marketing dollars move. Instead of buying a traditional commercial spot that everyone skips, brands like Starbucks and Dick's Sporting Goods are being woven directly into the event experience. It's an aggressive play to keep fans engaged rather than letting them scroll through their phones. They're even taking internet memes, like the infamous orange bag associated with Karl Anthony Towns, pronounced K-A-R-L and Thony T-O-W-N-S, and turning them into physical attractions. It creates a feedback loop where the product is the experience itself. Look, we've been watching the slow death of the traditional televised game for a while now. This is just the corporate acknowledgement that the old way of doing business is losing its grip. If you can make a press conference feel like a Coachella for sports nerds, why would anyone bother with a standard, sanitized broadcast? It's a smart move to capture that fear of missing out energy, but it also paints a bleak picture for the leagues that still insist on keeping their access locked behind a gate. Moving to the gridiron, the New York Jets are entering the 2026 season with what you might call a desperate short-term strategy. The team won only 3 games last year, leading to a complete overhaul of the coaching staff. Now, they've signed veteran quarterback Geno Smith to lead the offense. The front office is currently walking a tightrope. They need enough wins to keep their jobs, but they also want to maintain a high draft position to secure a long-term quarterback prospect next year. The entire plan rests on the offensive line repeating last year's performance to protect Smith, who has a documented history of throwing a high volume of interceptions. Head coach Aaron Glenn is taking over play-calling duties to try and boost the defense's turnover numbers. It is a classic win-now trap. If the team hits 6 wins, the staff might save their jobs. If the turnovers pile up, the whole thing likely collapses and clears the way for a total front office purge. It's a shitty situation to be in, honestly. They are effectively betting their entire future on a single, volatile season, hoping that a veteran quarterback can provide just enough stability to justify keeping the current regime around for another draft cycle. It's high variance, high stress, and entirely unsustainable if things go south by October. We'll see if they can thread that needle, but betting on a quarterback who is prone to game-changing turnovers is rarely a recipe for job security. That aggressive drive for eyeballs is exactly what the traditional press is trying to fight off. They are finally circling the wagons in Washington. The News Media Alliance and America's newspapers are merging their annual leadership summits into one joint event in Washington, D.C. This is a calculated pivot toward a unified lobbying front. For years, these organizations operated as separate entities with fragmented agendas. Now, they are moving to become active architects of federal policy regarding artificial intelligence and content protection. The industry has finally accepted that individual publishers cannot fight systemic threats on their own. We are talking about bad bots and unauthorized content scraping, which, frankly, is a hell of a thing to deal with when those bots start outnumbering human readers. They are dragging down site speeds and fueling a billion-dollar market built on intellectual property that doesn't belong to them. Since individual newsrooms lack the scale to fight this, they are looking to Washington for a way out. They want to copy the broadcast industry's lobbying model, leveraging local influence to secure federal protections that the free market has failed to provide. This shift marks a significant departure from the industry's long-standing tradition of keeping the government at arm's length. For decades, newspapers maintained a strict distance from Capitol Hill to preserve their editorial independence. Moving their primary leadership conference to the Capitol suggests that era is effectively over. Publishers are now signaling that they are willing to trade that traditional detachment for a seat at the regulatory table. It is a necessary evolution, but it comes with a price tag. Expect to see higher costs for compliance and lobbying efforts moving forward, as the industry bets that legal certainty is the only way to save their future business models. The strategy here is distinctly defensive. If the industry successfully lobbies for federal rules against unauthorized scraping, they effectively raise the barrier to entry for AI developers. The goal is to force those developers into collective licensing agreements, ensuring that if a machine wants to learn from a journalist's work, it has to pay for the privilege. It is a classic move to turn news content from an open resource into a protected asset. If they fail to secure these regulations, the outlook is pretty bleak. Publishers would be forced into an arms race, spending massive amounts of cash on bot-blocking infrastructure instead of newsrooms. Either that, or they simply accept slower site performance and the continued erosion of their revenue. There is also a practical, operational shift happening behind the scenes. These organizations are now incorporating technical training directly into their leadership summits. The goal is to bridge the internal knowledge gap that has left so many local newsrooms struggling to keep up with the digital reality. It means the job description for a local news leader is changing rapidly. You can no longer just be a good editor or a sharp business manager. You have to be technically literate enough to manage data rights and bot traffic. That is now considered as vital to survival as the actual reporting. It is a sobering reality for local journalism. The industry is essentially admitting that its long-term health is no longer dependent on the quality of its scoops or the loyalty of its subscribers, at least not exclusively. Success now requires them to function as a unified, politically active bloc, a lobbyist group with printing presses. They need to shape the regulatory environment to ensure that the economic value of their work stays with the people who actually report the news, rather than the aggregators who harvest it for free. It is a shitty situation, really. The fact that the newspaper industry has to beg the government to keep their own work from being pillaged by scrapers is a damning reflection of the current internet ecosystem. But look, being a purist about editorial independence doesn't matter much if you are bankrupt. If the choice is between being a principled, dying industry and a politically active one that might actually survive, you can see why they are packing their bags for DC. Whether this united front can actually move the needle remains to be seen. The broadcast industry has had decades to build their relationships on the Hill, and newspapers are essentially trying to catch up in an environment that is moving at the speed of an algorithm. They are betting everything on the idea that they still have enough local influence to make lawmakers listen. I am curious to see if that influence still holds weight when the companies they are fighting are the ones writing the future of the web. Anyway, they are going to find out soon enough. While those organizations try to save their own skin, a few people are looking inward to save their sanity. The Stoics are back in the management rotation. Marcus Aurelius is back in the management discourse. The core argument here is that leadership effectiveness relies on a strict separation between internal self-discipline and external expectations of others. By holding oneself to a high standard while remaining tolerant of colleagues, leaders supposedly avoid the bitterness that leads to burnout. The framework suggests using mortality as a filter for decision-making. Essentially, if a task wouldn't matter on your deathbed, it shouldn't be eating your mental energy today. It frames asking for help as a tactical necessity rather than a sign of weakness, which is a hell of a thing to say with a straight face in most corporate environments. Separately, the financial platform ramp is pushing the idea that businesses need to move toward what they call zero-touch finance. They argue that as AI agents take over routine tasks like invoice processing, companies will need to flatten their structures. The shift moves away from subspecialized departments and toward leaner teams of generalists. They are also positioning themselves to manage AI token spending as a new, major category of corporate overhead. It is a bold pivot, positioning a financial company as a competitor to AI labs by betting that intelligent resource allocation is the next big hurdle for growth. Finally, there is a push for proactive infrastructure stress testing. The theory is that growth compounds existing process flaws, turning small manual workarounds into major liabilities. The recommendation is to act as your own worst customer, submitting fake support tickets or overloading fulfillment workflows to break things on purpose before the market does it for you. It's an adversarial approach to operations. If you aren't auditing your own systems, you're just waiting for a growth spike to expose your incompetence. If you are going to stress test your own life like a piece of faulty software, you might as well look at the rest of the world while you are at it. A few other things worth knowing this morning. In the Euro 24 tournament, England is playing defense with a makeshift backline in the final against Spain due to ongoing fitness issues. It forces them to sacrifice their width and trade positional stability for a cautious, waiting game. Thomas Tuchel has a theory about why that looks so disjointed. He says it isn't about mentality or lack of effort, but a fundamental gap between the players' individual skills and their ability to actually execute a tactical plan on the field. Moving on to the cult of productivity, some high-profile guests are finally admitting that box office records and massive bank accounts don't actually buy peace of mind. Without a core purpose, the result is almost always the same, which is burnout and a habit of self-destruction that no amount of money can fix. The institutional fragility we discussed earlier is fueling a rise in rhetoric that frames state authorities, like the Federal Reserve or family courts, as part of a rigid, inescapable system. It is a convenient way to express deep-seated distrust, but it makes actual debate impossible because the language of systemic collapse has effectively replaced the language of governance. That is the state of things this Sunday morning. In a world where your data is the currency and your institutions are the ones selling it, stay skeptical of the default settings. I will see you tomorrow.